Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
What up, what up, what up? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, I'm Steele, Michael Steele. So glad you guys could be with us today. A lot of stuff that's been happening in just the last few days since we were last together with the Mueller report coming out, the president's reaction to it, the response by people across the country, which I take at this point was largely a big ho-hum, but we'll get into that a little bit. Certainly you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. I appreciate the downloads. Keep it coming. So let's just get into it. We got a little bit of the Mueller hangover at this point, folks. It's just, you know, I feel like we started down this road so long ago, and the tank was full, and the energy was high. And we got to last Friday, and folks were like, okay, can I get off here and just kind of park at a hotel and call it a night? And I think a lot of people felt that way. Well, I wanted to tap into some knowledge and some wisdom to help us kind of process what this hangover is all about and why we feel the way we feel about some of this stuff. Couldn't think anyone better than our guest today. He is an attorney and the co-founder of Savalas & Wong. He is Danny Savalas, and he is a criminal defense and civil litigation attorney with his own firm in Philadelphia area, which I love Philly. I spent a few years up that way at Villanova. But just as importantly for me, he's an MSNBC legal analyst, which means he's a colleague. And I told him, Danny, welcome, number one. And number two, I was telling you, as I said before, I'll tell the folks, you know, I wish I could be on air with you because sometimes you raise points. I'm like, man, that's it. Let's talk about that. Let's get into it. And you just bring such smart information and knowledge about the process, but more importantly, the substance of some of these big legal questions. So welcome to the podcast, man.
Wow, I am honored. Thank you so much. Hearing that from you, it's a mutual admiration society. So thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
No, it's a great pleasure. And so let's just deal with the hangover. You know, like most hangovers, sure. You know, folks go out, they find some aspirin and a lot of seltzer water or something.
Or they just keep drinking, Michael. Let's be honest.
Well, that's true.
What some of them do.
I have been in that room, yes, where I just I have rationalized, you know what? I'm at this point. I might as well just keep going. And sometimes you do.
That's right.
So what do you – what's your just broad – let's start big, and we'll get down into the weeds of it a little bit. What is your broad takeaway from what we saw happen with Mueller's report? I felt for a long time that this was actually going to be one of the more anticlimactic legal and political events in modern times, quite honestly, particularly given the buildup to it. And I don't think I was too wrong on that. So I want to get your thoughts there. But also,
right.
You know, from the sense of this big picture, what does it mean?
Yeah. I think for many people, the Mueller report and the Barr letter of last week represented the tragedy of high expectations. When I think for people who, when Mueller was first appointed, who thought, okay, if they saw Mueller as somebody who's going after Trump and is going to, with the objective of taking him down, then I think they were setting themselves up for disappointment, because as the investigation rolled along, we were given glimpses into the progress, not from Mueller's team themselves, but almost as close by their speaking indictments, which gave us a running narrative of what exactly was going on. And one of the things they concluded early on was, yes, there was Russian interference with the election. Yes, there was a Russian social media campaign against the United States. Yes, the United States was under attack. But all along, there never really was any indictment of any person directly affiliated with Trump for that Russia collusion. So you could say that the hints were there, the clues were there early on. And
so
anybody, I can understand. So what was the point? The point was to investigate the existence of Russia collusion. And in that sense, on the collusion side, you could argue there was some success, because they concluded, they found actual Russian interference in the election and disseminated that as a public fact, something that the public could digest. But ultimately, I mean, I think people are disappointed. It's strange to think about the magnitude of indictments, arguably of Russians that will never see a courtroom, but the amount of Russia actual interference discovered and released by the Mueller team is impressive. But I think what people were disappointed about is that there was no direct tie from the Trump campaign to that Russian interference with the election. And that's the Russia collusion component. And then maybe just to add on at the end, because the other major prong was the obstruction prong, I think when you asked what was the point, I think for the public, I think the firing of James Comey really raised the issue of obstruction, which, you know, it warranted an investigation, but maybe we should have had an idea where everybody stood on two major issues. Number one, can the president obstruct justice? And number two, can you indict a sitting president?
See, this is why I want to be, this is why I love listening to you and getting into the meat of this stuff, because you raise these questions with your points. And the first one I've got is, don't you think then we got punked? That people got punked from the very beginning of this process, which I believe they did, with this whole idea of collusion. I marvel at the day Donald Trump rolled that argument out there, because that was never something that was brought up officially as a request of Mueller. Go find collusion. It was not about that. It was go find Russian, you know, tell us there was Russian interference and then what came from it. Trump came out of the starting gate and defined this thing as collusion. First off, collusion is not a crime. All right. So,
right.
Duh. Second of all, it's like playing in smoke. All it does is burn your eyes and choke you out. It doesn't reveal anything necessarily. And that's what this was. So people got punked from the very beginning going down this road of believing that there was this, you know, this collusion was the crime. So when you start bringing in these other elements, they seem almost outside of what we've been told or defined as what we're looking for, number one. And number two, they don't marry up, as you said. I mean, you've got to answer those two questions, you know. Can the president obstruct? And if he does, can you indict him for it? And for me, it was always about the corruption. I remember saying from the beginning, follow the money. This is all things in Washington at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
boil down to money. There was money somewhere in the process. Someone got paid. Someone wants money. In this case, he wants a hotel deal. There's the transactions. It's the money. And we kind of got lost in the weeds of all of that. And I just started feeling this Mueller thing was just going to go nowhere fast. And so didn't we get punked from the very beginning and started the track we were on would never going to get us to where we ultimately think we would lined up?
Well, I don't know about punked, but I think in many ways, because we had no information coming from the Mueller team, at least officially, other than their indictments, we were left to guess at what direction they were going. And along the way, there were plenty of things. I think there were plenty of activities that had they gone a few steps further would have fallen into the realm of some kind of criminal, I guess, I hate collusion because you're right, it's not a legal term, but some criminal conspiracy to computer hack or something else. You know, when you look at the Roger Stone indictment, the activities that he was engaged in were really, really close. Just a few more steps or a few more active encouragement efforts by the campaign, and I think you do start getting into the conspiracy land, at least in terms of conspiring with Julian Assange or with WikiLeaks. I mean, I think there were plenty of close calls, but you know, I don't know that we were punked all along the way. I think it was an important investigation. I think it yielded important indictments, although they're of questionable value if they're never, ever, ever going to lead to any kinds of convictions or trials. But I think it was important to have law enforcement investigate Russian interference and investigate, well, maybe as a secondary issue, investigating the possible obstruction issue with Comey. But, you know, that to me, you know, the Russia collusion gave us some finality. There appears to be no Russia collusion. We can put that to bed. But I think the obstruction conclusions have now raised more questions than they've answers. And I think that many folks are not seeing this as a hangover. I think many diehard want to see Trump go down at any cost folks are seeing the obstruction non-collusion as not resolving anything. And I understand where they're coming from, because it really doesn't. It leaves open a lot of questions about obstruction. And here's the important thing, a crime, the fact that there was no crime as to obstruction is, you know, a crime is neither a necessary nor a sufficient grounds for impeachment. So the impeachment talks continue in light of the obstruction non-conclusion.
Well, but here's the deal. So again, you've raised another question and point that I think is worth exploring, and that sits on this idea of we don't actually know what's in the Mueller report, right? So, because that's not been revealed. Do you trust what Attorney General Barr has put out as his interpretation of it? Basically, he just poo-pooed out of the gate. Oh, well, you know, there is no obstruction. Well, how do we know that? That's your interpretation.
Well, that's really
interesting. So what do we do when we get the report and we sit there and go, dude, there's a whole bunch of obstruction in here. What are you talking about?
Right. That's the interesting thing. And I think it's even made more interesting. And we're talking just about the obstruction prong right now, because that we could devote a whole chapter to that one alone. Because notice that Mueller refrained from making any prosecutorial decisions. I think a lot of folks are scratching their heads. That's a big question. And frankly, I don't know the reason why. There doesn't appear to be any reason that we know of right now why Mueller would make the choice to not reach any conclusion. I have a theory, and it's that if Mueller started his investigation with the operative, policy that we do not indict sitting presidents, maybe Mueller viewed it as his obligation under DOJ regs and the principles of federal prosecution, which are a published manual, formerly the U.S. Attorney's manual. If he believed that he couldn't indict a sitting president no matter what, maybe that's how he viewed his job, that I won't make a prosecutorial decision because I cannot. And therefore, what I will do is marshal the facts on both sides. As he said, there's evidence on both sides, and then leave that for the person with the real power to make a decision, Attorney General Barr. So if that theory fits into an explanation why Mueller won't make a prosecutorial decision, then when it gets to Barr, the really fascinating thing I found is that Barr made a point of raising the fact that he didn't reach the issue of whether or not a sitting president can be indicted. That's nice. But there's a related, not the same fact. It sounds similar, but it's not the same. The issue of whether a president can obstruct justice. And that's an issue that it was very peculiar for Barr not to reach at all, because he wrote an entire 19-page memorandum on the topic and concluded that, largely, that a president doesn't obstruct justice when he exercises his constitutionally given powers, which, you know, I guess you could say reasonable legal minds could differ. I tend to differ. I tend to think that any lawful act like a pardon that you do with a corrupt motive or for a bag of dirty cash or something like that makes a lawful act still lawful, but the underlying conduct is illegal. It's corrupt. So I don't agree with that conclusion, but, you know, that's why Barr's letter leaves more questions unanswered as to obstruction than it actually answered. And just as a last issue, yes, he only took 2 days, but I think realistically, and maybe you have some perspective on this, I think realistically, given the relationship pre-existing between Barr and Mueller, I think that Barr was apprised of what was going on well in advance of that 2 day time period that he apparently made those decisions. I think he probably had a few more days or a week than just that to make that decision.
I think so. And of course, I'm so mistrustful of the process. I still wouldn't be surprised if we find out that, you know, there were communications even with the White House at some point in that process. I mean, it just the whole thing to me just smells so friggin' bad, and it feels terrible, and it leaves a bad taste in your mouth because you do have this overwhelming sense. And look, the criminal intent behind an effort to prejudice a case or disrupt a case or to change the outcome of the case is hard to prove. You know that. I mean, it's just, you know, getting into to particularly with someone like the president who you can't touch or reach. Oh, by the way, they didn't even bother calling the man in to interview him. So
right.
that told me when that decision was made not to interview the president, that was game, set, match. Trump won this argument. You put him in that space where he all of a sudden has to tell what he knows and try to cover his tracks the way Trump covers his tracks. That would have been a shit show beyond words. We know that, okay? Having said that, where do we go now with all of this? You know, the Dems are sitting there and poor things, you know, God bless them. They're so crestfallen and beside themselves, and they were so geared up on impeachment, and they're so geared up on the Mueller report coming out to just slam the president. And Nancy Pelosi has snatched away the impeachment rug, and Bob Mueller didn't even, deliver the goods. He didn't even, come with a bag of Chinese food to sit down and talk about it. I mean, it's just nothing.
Right.
Where do they go now? Have they just gone too far in their anticipation of all of this and what they think the outcome should be?
No, I think Democrats, I hate to say a global I told everyone so, but here I go. I mean, and I'm not alone. A lot of folks were saying, especially in the last month or so or a couple months, that it may be the case that the Mueller investigation really isn't the biggest threat to the Trump administration. It really, the greater threat has always been the other investigations, possibly the congressional investigations, the Southern District of New York, the State of New York investigations, which, remember, cannot be the subject of a self-pardon. So if the State of New York gets anything solid on any Trump folks at all, that's immune from any pardon by the president. So right. In a way, Mueller's investigation from the beginning, and the clues were all there. It was narrow in focus. It was the mandate was narrow. It was two major areas of investigation. And, here's Trump, a guy who doesn't use email, doesn't text message. There's not going to be much of an electronic paper trail to him. And so even though you indicted several people in his coterie, most of them, I have to point out, I don't know. I don't see the, far more socially significant are the indictments of Russian nationals for interfering in the election. I mean, the fact that Michael Flynn lied to investigators, the fact that Roger Stone misled it or lied to Congress or lied to, gave false statements. And that's a crime that exists by definition only as a product of the investigation itself. It didn't exist prior to the investigation. So it's created by it. It's the sine qua non. So I don't know that you can look at that the Dems can look at the indictments of Flynn or Roger Stone as huge victories. But if the Dems are looking for a silver lining, they have it in the form of the Southern District of New York's investigation, which is ongoing. The fact that Michael Cohen is cooperating and doing anything he can to get a reduced sentence. And that there are state investigations and to no small degree, the congressional investigations that are ongoing. But I think politically, if this goes on too long and makes its way into the election cycle, this could backfire on congressional Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, I've said Nancy Pelosi has been smart about the whole impeachment approach. Now they get to manage these other expectations. And to that end, you've got these other investigations going right now in the House, and not so much in the Senate, but certainly in the House. Those narratives, while they may yield some new information and possibly some political opportunities, as you said, they are fraught with a lot of problems. I mean, they don't necessarily or come off as promising because the Mueller piece hangs over everything so heavily that everything else now looks like it's just political aggrandizement or sort of the gotcha politics.
That's right. I think that's going to be a real challenge for Democrats, because I think there are there are definitely things to investigate about Donald Trump. I mean, I think there's some very plain evidence. I'll give you an example. I mean, here's a fence post that really doesn't have much to do with interpretation. Last summer, I wondered aloud at whether or not campaign finance law violations were really crimes, because there are a lot of things that are crimes, but, you know, not really. And I think the John Edwards non-conviction for campaign finance law violations had people wondering, you know, it's technically a crime, but can you even really get a conviction on campaign finance law violations? And the answer to that question came to me very abruptly when I was standing out in front of the Southern District of New York and Michael Cohen walked in to plead guilty to exactly that crime and to implicate the president in open court. And in that moment, I realized, oh my goodness, not only does the government see campaign finance law as a real crime, but Michael Cohen just admitted to it, and the government essentially put their thumbprint of approval on him saying that the president directed it. So, I mean, I think, you know, even back then I thought, okay, well, that's that. I mean, it sounds like that's enough for an indictment, and that's coming from the Southern District.
Right.
So maybe, you know, we had the hints all along that the Mueller investigation promised nothing, at least compared to these other investigations that are ongoing.
You almost ask yourself, why did we do it? Why did we waste 2 years of
right.
this? Because it just seemed from the very beginning that this trail was fraught with all kinds of weeds and potholes and you know, branches that you had to overcome, that you walk the trail and you get to the end of it and you realize, didn't we start here?
No, you're totally right. And you know, as somebody who does criminal defense, you know, I'm kind of mindful of the resources that are expended, you know, on both sides. And, you know, you think about all of the manpower and tremendous brain power. I mean, really a Justice League America of prosecutors that were assembled to investigate this. And that's a lot of manpower. And it just, you know, it strikes me as a shame that all this time was invested. But at the same time, you know, to the degree they ferreted out criminality in the interference with the election, I think that's very, very important. And I think it's sort of swept under the rug because Trump is just such a high profile target for many that anything short of an indictment of Trump, for many who wanted that, they're just tragically disappointed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think in a sense, if that's what they were expecting, then they really were setting themselves up for disappointment, because just looking at a simple flow chart, you know, number one, there's an open question that the president can even be indicted. The DOJ policy is that he cannot. There's an open question whether the president can obstruct justice. It's, you know, the AG says he cannot. So the funny thing about the Mueller report is it's supposed to be under the regulations, a report of prosecution decisions and declinations. But there weren't going to be any prosecution decisions that surprised us because they were already indictments. So the only thing the Mueller report by definition was going to be a prosecution declination memorandum,
right.
Something about the people who did maybe something suspicious, but not enough to warrant a crime. So there were so many clues that maybe the Mueller report was not going to be the panacea that at least the Democrats wanted it to be.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. But there is, my good friend, a sword of Damocles that hangs over one Donald Trump. And that would be known as the sword of SDNY, the Southern District of New York. Walk us through that relative to the Mueller probe, because I think also, as a little asterisk on Mueller, I think there's some stuff that they've pushed out to the Southern District and maybe Washington, the other jurisdiction involved here, that we just don't know about yet. But talk about that. I mean, particularly from your perspective as a defense lawyer, you've got to be sitting there going, brother, you got some problems.
Yes, he does.
The state piece is not the same as the Mueller piece.
Right. That's right. And so just going to the Southern District of New York so that folks can understand, you know, to me, now I think I understand why Mueller farmed out part of this to the Southern District, because probably Mueller realized his mandate was narrow. And once it sounds like they executed search warrants on Michael Cohen's home and uncovered all of this treasure trove of information about him, they probably realized, I'm guessing that Mueller's team thought about it this way. Look, we have this narrow mandate. This is arguably not really within our mandate. I mean, they, almost by definition, we can infer that they found a bunch of stuff that wasn't related to their mandate. And that's why it ended up over at the Southern District of New York. Mm-hmm. And just from what we know publicly, there's already enough, as I said briefly earlier, there's already enough, arguably, to incriminate the president. And we know, here's one thing, there was a lot of evidence that this campaign couldn't have colluded with themselves, let alone Russia. Right. They were not highly organized. So along the way, for them to so staunchly deny any contact with Russia, you know, I don't know. After a while, I thought, well, it is possible they never colluded with Russia. But just in the hints that we've gotten about how Donald Trump ran his businesses before he became president, those have some very obvious problems with him. I'll just give you an example. I mean, notice how quickly Donald Trump settled the Trump University lawsuit as soon as he was elected to the presidency. What a surprise, because had he been dragged into depositions, that might have been a disaster. I mean, it was arguably almost, at least under the AG's definition, a criminal type enterprise to run this Trump University and apparently bilk people out of their money. I mean, just that's one example of how he ran his business. And then Michael Cohen describing audio taping the president using his money to make payoffs to porn stars and whomever else and women that he's had relationships with. And then even more astoundingly, Michael Cohen using these absolutely, from a lawyer's perspective, ridiculous financial shell games with his financial accounts. I mean, the way they did business was just strange at minimum. So for that reason alone, the fact that the Southern District of New York may be investigating their finances, and we know already that the Southern District of New York has resulted in a conviction that directly implicates the president in a crime, I think it's pretty realistic to conclude that the Southern District of New York takes the position that the president has committed at least one crime.
Right.
And we know that the state authorities are investigating as well on some grounds that, I mean, just what we're hearing about what he may have done with, at least according to Michael Cohen, with his charities, his charitable organizations. I mean, those are bizarre activities. And if they're offering immunity to his chief accountant, Weisselberg, I mean, these are all very bad things for Trump. And in a way, maybe the Mueller investigation was always the least of his worries.
Why have people so underestimated the state part of this? And, you know, I think Trump is more worried about it now. I think that has colored a lot of his actions. And in one sense, he's beating his breast on Mueller. But I think, you know, he's got, you know, his toes are tapping on when it comes to Southern District of New York as sort of nervous energy, because he doesn't know, or maybe he does have some degree of knowledge of what that could potentially mean. Certainly what the impact on his children, Don Jr. and Ivanka, I think it could be a potential leverage point as well. But why have people sort of not really seeing that as the sword that, you know, sword of Damocles, as I've said? I think it's the bigger threat, the more dangerous piece. And yet it has not received the kind of cachet. You've talked about it, and you've raised the points here. You kind of said, danger, Will Robinson, danger, sort of warning.
Right.
But
right.
Everyone's kind of whistles past that particular graveyard. What's up with that?
Well, I'll tell you why. I think it comes down to nothing. It really could be as simple as just a good old fashioned lack of respect for state authorities compared to federal authorities. Yeah. I mean, you see it in movies. You see it. It's a common trope that you just sort of say, oh, a state investigation, fine, but whoa, the feds are involved? Uh-oh, that's a big problem. And, to a large degree, as a criminal defense attorney, I would much prefer, very generally speaking, I would much prefer to defend a case in state court versus federal court, because the federal authorities have fewer cases, they've got more resources to put into each case, and they approach an investigation first by, as now remember, I'm a jaded criminal defense attorney, but most of the federal cases start as investigations where they've concluded that somebody's doing something shady, and then they build evidence until they think they have a case. State court has to handle all the cases, so they're reactive. Their cases sometimes fall apart because they don't have the resources to handle the volume, but that's not necessarily the case with an investigation of Trump, because they're going to focus quite a few resources on it. So you're absolutely right. People do poo-poo the state investigation, but they shouldn't. They shouldn't, because it can be just as dangerous to Trump, arguably more dangerous, at least after he leaves the presidency. There's definitely precedent that suggests that it's less likely that a state prosecutor could indict a president than a federal prosecutor. But I mean, that's just some precedent that even recently has been under attack. Mm-hmm. So, at least after he leaves the office, I think arguably the lesser paid attention to New York authorities or other state authorities pose just as big a threat to Donald Trump, if not a greater threat.
Interesting. It is a fascinating narrative and storyline that I think we're going to be talking about in a big way. In terms of the timetable on that, do you see the SDNY case slash cases moving into or being a part of the 2020 cycle? Is that something that the way the process typically works, that you really don't get to the meat of that, where subpoenas and all of those types of procedures don't take place until like 2021, for example?
Right. Well, a couple of reasons why I think the Southern District of New York case is going to be ongoing for a while. There are a couple hints there. Number one is that Michael Cohen is still trying to cooperate to reduce his sentence post-sentencing, which is something that you can do in the federal system. But that means that he's still providing them information. And when you look at also the terabytes of information seized from Michael Cohen, the notion that the end of the investigation would just be him pleading guilty to a couple, financial crimes here and there, that doesn't seem logical. There must be more to the Southern District of New York case. And the investigation, the general rule of thumb is, however long you think an investigation will be, add on some more time. And so that brings us smack dab in the middle of the 2020 election cycle. So I think the Southern District of New York will be a very relevant investigation during that time. And it's interesting how much politics might play a part in that investigation, because, as much as the DOJ would say it's not, it absolutely, like anything else, it has an element of politics to it. So it'll be really interesting to see if they have more, the timing of any rollout of any indictments or anything else coming out of any U.S. attorney's offices, not just the Southern District of New York.
And Roger Stone is going to be a wet blanket on all of this, because he's not going to cooperate diddly. I don't see him turning anything. This guy, is doing the Nixon victory signs going in and out of the courtroom.
Right.
So for him, this is all part of the show. And Roger Stone will go to jail, and he's fine with that.
Yep. And he's fine with it. You're right. I wrote a column a few weeks ago, and I'll tell you, it's rare that I make predictions that come true, but I predicted several weeks ago that Roger Stone, when the judge issued a gag order, that not only would he violate it, but he would violate it quickly, and he would violate it intentionally, because this is the best thing that ever happened to Roger Stone, is getting indicted, because it's his opportunity to be on the pedestal, to make a scene, and he still has an outside chance at a pardon. In fact, I would argue that Trump, if Trump is going to pardon anyone, and if I were advising him, I'd tell him don't pardon anybody at all. But since he doesn't listen to his lawyers,
right,
he would do whatever he wants to do. And then I would say, since you're not going to listen to me, from a political standpoint, this may be your best opportunity to start issuing pardons, because you've just gotten a clean bill of health so that there won't be any underlying corruption in these pardons. I mean, you've essentially been exonerated. I'm not truly exonerated, but as close to it as you're going to get. So now's the time to pardon folks. And I'd be interested to see if he sends out a few tweets and starts pardoning folks like Stone and even Flynn. Not Manafort, but maybe Stone and Flynn.
But that's always been an interesting feature on the pardon side for me, because you are pardoning them for criminal behavior unrelated to your campaign and unrelated to the underlying investigation by Mueller, right?
Right.
And in the course of that investigation, they discovered all these other things. So, which I'm sure Trump would argue had nothing to do with him. So it almost makes the pardon a little bit laughable, in the sense that you're pardoning them. Well, not even laughable is the wrong word. It would make it, I'd be offended by it, because you're pardoning them for something that, for criminal activity that they, to use the word perversely, legitimately engaged in. In other words, they went out and they did these
right.
things that were unrelated to Donald Trump and any deals or relationships with the Russians or his presidency.
Right.
You know, didn't pay your taxes, et cetera. And he's going to pardon you for that. It just seems to me like, wow, how slimy is this?
Well, you know, you make a really good point. And, you know, if you look at the entire history of the pardon power, that's exactly, the pardon power itself is ridiculous. I mean, it's from its beginnings, it was inserted as a way to show mercy when the executive believes that somebody's been wrongfully prosecuted. But doesn't the pardon power represent a massive waste of time? I mean, after all,
yes.
by definition, it's a conviction attained by the executive branch through the DOJ, through their hard work, indictments, juries, trials, manpower hours. I mean, all this time invested. And then the same executive branch, the head executive, just undoes it all.
It
sounds so silly.
It's
the most ridiculous power. And yet we've just accepted it for the last, you know, 200 years or more. And it's something that came over from the royal tradition, but it's by its very definition, it's a complete waste of time. It's a very inefficient power. So we've had a rich history of presidents issuing very dubious pardons, including of brothers, of, you know, relatives and people who were, you know, friendly to the president. I mean, the pardon power itself is not very efficiently or really fairly administered when done by the president. Now, when it's done by the pardon office, maybe more so. But by definition, every person pardoned did something wrong. They did something really bad.
Yeah.
They got convicted.
Exactly. They got convicted. And there it is. So, well, my man, this has been great, Danny. Danny Savalas, thank you so much for spending some time helping us walk through this quagmire of crazy known as the Mueller investigation and all of its attendant tentacles. Really appreciate the insight. It's just smart conversation and smart information.
I got to tell you, thank you so much. Such an honor to be on your show. I remember probably 10 years ago or so, I before I was doing any media, I saw you on the Acela, you know, riding,
yes.
probably going on one of your million rides. And I went home and told my family, hey, guess who I saw? And now I get to be on your show many years later. It's very cool. And this is just a great business to be able to work with you. And it's really neat.
Same here. And you keep doing you, boo, as they say, because you do it well. It's smart stuff, folks. Well, when you hear that Danny's going to be on MSNBC, stop what you're doing, tune in. You will learn a lot and be better informed about not just the process, but the substance of the law and the questions that right now our country is trying to grapple with. And I can't think of anyone better who's putting that information out there than you. Thanks, Danny, very, very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Please have me back.
You
Thank
got
you.
It. Absolutely. So, folks, that does it for this round. You know, we got many more rounds to come because the crazy don't stop. We're going to cover it. Certainly, we want you to download us at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. But before I go, Just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know what happens to most of us at some point or another? Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is? How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, how can we make this much and still have so much debt? Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finances. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. And now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save. And take control of your finances with a loan from BestEgg.com. Visit BestEgg.com/plan. That's BestEgg.com/plan. I'm Michael Steele. This is the Michael Steele Podcast. Peace out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Build a polished wardrobe that shows you stay you wherever you go with Mack Weldon. Use code MACK25 for 25% off your first order of $125 or more at MackWeldon.com.